Status, you're invisible. Don't get in the way. Answer every question the masked man asks, but don't ask any of your own. Pay taxes, get takeout, plug in, and shut up. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dave Johnson, Hannah Francis, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Simone Perez, Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlie, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Cheryl Denise.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Today, we take a deeper look into one of Street Root's articles, K-8 School Next Door to Portland ICE Facility Plans Immediate Move. The Cottonwood School is scrambling to move into a new building just weeks before the start of the school year, saying federal agents' treatment of protesters endangers students. Here with me is the author of this article, Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden.
Hey, Jeremiah. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Cottonwood School is located directly next to the ICE building. There's some railroad tracks between, but that's pretty much it. And your article says that the Cottonwood School has plans to move as quickly as possible because they feel that it's dangerous for the students to be so close to the ICE facility. Could you elaborate a little bit on why they feel it's so dangerous?
As I'm sure you know, and most Portlanders know at this point, that ICE facility down in South Portland, it's right off the Willamette River. It's right next door to this school, something that people have mentioned for a long, long time since the ICE building moved in 2011. And, you know, it's next to the OHSU facility. It's next to a low-income housing development. And these people at the school, school officials, you know, over the years have seen tear gas deployed. They find rubber bullets on their playground. This is something that has become very prominent, you know, in these last few months as protests have kind of ramped up in opposition to Donald Trump's deportation efforts. And the school, I mean, if you go down there, you can stand right outside of that school. I was down there talking with some people from PERC, Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, about a month ago, and you can just feel the tear gas still in the air from the night before when these federal agents, you know, take those aggressions out on protesters. So this is really not a safe environment for students who are trying to just, you know, learn at school.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also really important to note who exactly Cottonwood is blaming for this danger. Could you explain specifically who they're blaming there?
Yeah. I agree with you. There's often a framing, and I don't want to put anything on anyone for what their intentions are with that, but it can be really easy to blame protesters for something like this. And that is not what the Cottonwood School is doing here. They've been very clear in any of their communications that this is the federal response to those protests. I think here in Portland, you know, kind of a well-known city, in part thanks to Donald Trump's efforts here in 2020, for pushing back on an administration that is trying to do a lot of damage to cities that, you know, sanctuary cities in particular, especially here in 2025. So the protesters, I think, you know, through a lot of these statements, it seems clear that the Cottonwood School tends to, at least publicly, understand that protesters are there against certain policies, and then the administration's response to that is what's actually causing all of the dangers.
Right. Yeah. And Cottonwood is trying to move really quickly because school is supposed to start at the beginning of September. What are some of their options for relocating?
They basically found two options, you know, within these last, you know, this last month or so. They have been intending to move to a permanent location at some point. They've been talking about that for quite a while. Just recently, they decided that they needed to move before the beginning of the school year, yeah, which is like August 18th for teachers. And they could move into a PPS owned facility in North Portland, I think off of Alberta. And then they had another one in Southwest Portland that's just a mile or so from their current location. There are a lot of feelings about this, and I do hope that we can touch on that in a minute. One of the buildings, you know, that's owned by PPS is much more expensive, and that it's a very different neighborhood. And so certain people were saying, you know, I would leave the school if we moved to North Portland. And then other, you know, students and staff were saying, I would leave the building if we stay in Southwest, you know, for various reasons that I'm sure we'll talk about.
Absolutely. One of the schools, I think what you're talking about is the Bridges Middle School building, is owned by the Lindquist Development Company, which is also owns the ICE facility and, for the matter, the Tesla plant behind it. So yeah, that kind of complicates this all a bit, right? Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's worth mentioning, you know, this landlord, Stuart Lindquist, and the, you know, this whole kind of family business that he has, this real estate business, is not just a passive actor here. This is someone who attacked ICE protesters in a Occupy ICE protest in 2018 with his car. And then when interviewed by Willamette Week about the incident, you know, at 70 some years old, said that he would come out and fight each and every ICE protester. So people raise a lot of concerns about this, largely because, you know, if you're going to be holding students, students of color, immigrant students, and if you're going to be holding data on those students and their families in your facility, they need some reassurances that that owner isn't going to simply allow people, allow ICE agents into the building to detain people or to come in and get data about students that could really endanger them. This was the central point of a board meeting that I went to on Monday night. And that is the central tension here, is not only, you know, not only what I was just talking about with endangering students, but also the idea of supporting a real estate developer who is profiting off of ICE by, you know, leasing the building to them. It was a very contentious meeting. You know, we don't go into it a ton in the article here, but the board meeting was 3 hours long, and the data shows from the surveys that the school did that the people who are most likely to leave the school and disenroll from the school are the students of color and their families, while, you know, a large majority of the people who were said that they would disenroll if it moved to North Portland are white families. And it's a state-funded charter school, and so the school kind of is in this really, I think, tough position, because they get their funding based on how many enrollees they have at their school. But but this whole thing represents a lot of, you know, pretty broad issues of what people are facing today under the Trump administration fascism that is trying to tear apart communities in a very, you know, sort of bureaucratic way. And this is one of those tests for how do it, you know, what kind of came out of this board meeting is that it appears to be in one of these tests that of what do you do when, you know, the Trump administration's various forms of violence come at you, and who do you protect? And the thing that I took most out of that is that everyone is scared.
That's really interesting. Thanks for that insight there. So activists have been calling for the removal of the permit of the ICE facility in Portland, or the revoking of the permit, which a couple of the Cottonwood School parents submitted testimony to in support of the ICE facility permit being revoked. But that process would obviously be way too slow for the Cottonwood School to stay there by a long shot. And it's detailed actually in your article a little bit. Would you tell us a little bit about what the process of revoking the permit would actually look like?
Yes, and it's a mouthful because there are a few things that the city approved through the city council, this conditional use that is actually not really a permit. And so this is something interesting that I think came out of this reporting is an email that we got of the deputy city administrator in charge of that area of the city saying basically there is not a permit to revoke. This is a conditional use. That's the kind of thing where, you know, say somebody wanted to open a McDonald's in the South Waterfront, just for example, they would go through this conditional use thing and say, does this actually fit kind of the vibe of the neighborhood? The conditional use is a sort of vibes-based thing. Is this kind of what this area is intended to be? And, you know, that permit, strangely, you know, goes to the federal government in this way. There's not a whole lot that the city can do in that regard because it's a tenant. The tenant is the federal government, which is the federal government, you know? And anyways, the point being that if the city was to receive a complaint about the tenants at the ICE facility, in this case, the federal government, violating the rules of that conditional use, then the city could open an investigation. The federal government has to let them into the building. If the federal government doesn't let them in, they go to the circuit court and ask for a warrant to get into the building so that they could find whether or not they violated that conditional use, in which case they could start to levy fines against the tenant. But still, there's no permit to revoke there. It's just a daily fine. This is something that the city did back in 2020 when the feds put up a big fence outside the federal courthouse and they were blocking a bike lane. So there are ways of trying to hold the government accountable, but just simply revoking a permit is not one of them. And I know that that is like a very, something that will potentially make a lot of people angry. It's just where things are at. And then there's another, you know, a land use statement that could be that the city council, if in another world that we can all imagine, you know, if they find some violations of that, then the city council could try to pull some of those decisions. It's really complicated. It can be super boring. And I think it also kind of goes back to that, you know, thing we were talking about earlier about how the bureaucratic sort of things can lead to these, you know, really terrible violences because they're so sticky. Just bureaucracy is just so sticky and messy that this just isn't quite as simple as it might seem as just pulling a permit.
Right.
I don't know. I'll add, I don't know if anyone is going to stick with me on what I just said about permits.
So despite how complicated and convoluted that process is, and the fact that it probably can't actually result in the ICE facility moving out of Portland. The first step has been taken in this process, right? A complaint has been filed. Actually multiple, right?
Yeah, there were two complaints filed on July 21st. This is sort of just after some of this information about how the city might challenge this conditional use came out. July 21st, they received two complaints, and they alleging violations of the conditional use. And then the city initiated those steps outlined in that process that I just talked about, which came from a memo that we got through public records. It's one of those things where it's kind of maybe starting a process that may not have the kind of outcome that people are hoping for, but it is moving along in a certain way, and this sort of slow bureaucratic stuff and trying to hold the U.S. government accountable for local land use laws is a long process. It's not something that's going to happen quickly. And to sort of end that, I think what's really interesting here in this story is that the city, the neighbors, the community in general is, in light of that, trying to be creative in how it can address actual problems for actual human beings, even in the midst of some like very lofty and like very well-intentioned things to hold the federal government accountable. This is fascism, and people are doing everything that they can to stop things in a big way. And then there's all these other like really, really the minutia of the thing. People are really getting creative in that area.
Yeah. There are other measures being taken to sort of protect the residents of Portland, or other pathways investigated. And one of those, right, is city councilors are considering banning the use of tear gas altogether. So what are the steps to doing that look like?
There are a few committees that are looking at this. It's come up in a presentation recently in the Public Safety Committee about Oregon's and Portland's sanctuary laws. The federal government, I think we all understand the federal government at this point in time appears to be able to do anything it wants, and no one is stopping them. But I spoke with Councilor Samir Kanal from District 2, and he said that's not really a reason not to try. And they're looking into, through the Climate Committee and through that Public Safety Committee, a way of banning the use of tear gas within the city limits. There are a lot of things that this would have to go through. There is the Portland Police Bureau and those directives, and I don't know that anybody is necessarily ready to try to get into that battle with the local police or not. But as far as the federal government is concerned, that they are still bound in some ways to these kinds of laws. And so there's a, within those committees, one of the, in the new structure, government structure that started this year, they're able to call in experts, they're able to present data, healthcare workers who have like responded to tear gas, the environmental experts on what this does to the Willamette River just two blocks away, and the fish in the river. And so this is maybe a method where there can be some sort of accountability and try to set up some sort of rules about the use of tear gas within the city limits. Councilor Kanal told me, this is happening in the South Waterfront right now, but there's no reason to think that this couldn't be happening just anywhere else in the city at any point. So it is in the public's interest to not have neighborhoods, people sitting inside their houses, just being blanketed in tear gas. It's pretty controversial, but.
Yeah. Very controversial right now, actually. Kanal says that even if the city does actually pass an ordinance, the federal officers might not respect it.
Yeah. Everyone, I think, is aware of this. There are a lot of calls for the city council to do something here. I think there are a lot of calls, from anyone's perspective at this point in our history, for anyone to do anything. It's just they're people are terrified, and people have access to their government now in a way that they have never had before here in Portland. So people are really reaching out, trying to get someone to do something about this. And I think from what I can tell, people are responding, maybe not publicly as much as people would, as the community would like, but at least in certain ways are trying to respond to these, that, you know, the needs of the community. And Councillor Canall said, you know, it is a concern that the federal government will just go further into lawlessness in how they behave. He said, but I think Portland, we stand for the rule of law, we stand for due process, and I think we're going to legislate with that assumption and then react according to how they comply or don't comply.
The best we can do, I guess.
It is at this point.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about this article?
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for your time, Jeremiah. Lastly, where can people find this article?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. They're in your neighborhood. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. And you can also find us at streetroots.org.
For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. I have here with me Laura Grimes, Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to talk about three of their latest pieces. Hi, Laura. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Hannah.
Absolutely. So first off, let's talk about this national story, which is unfortunately affecting us all. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting declares it must shut down. The shutdown, pushed by the Trump administration and Congress, cuts funding to national public radio and the public broadcasting system, and threatens regional affiliates, including OPB and all classical radio. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Well, we have lots of news this week. This first story up is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting announced Friday that it will be forced to shut down next year after Congress clawed back $1.1 billion that had been previously approved for the next 7 years. CPB, which was founded in 1967, has provided crucial federal funding to public broadcasting system and national public radio, which in turn helped to bankroll local and regional broadcasters across the nation. In Oregon, that includes KBOO FM, Oregon Public Broadcasting, All Classical Radio, Jazz Station KMHD, Southern Oregon PBS, and Jefferson Public Radio. With this lack of funding, KBOO is losing about $110,000 annually, roughly 10% of its budget. OPB will lose about $5 million annually, about 9% of its total budget. All Classical will lose $500,000 each year, or $1 million over the next 2 years, which amounts to 10% of its budget. It's important to note that people living in rural and remote areas will be especially hard hit because they might not have a lot of other sources of news or access to information, places that the internet doesn't exist, and radio waves are especially important. So another critical funding item that flies under the radar is that CPB will no longer be able to negotiate or pay for music licenses for stations, which will be a huge additional expense. CPB will continue to support public broadcasters through a transition period that will end in January.
That's right. Yeah, they're laying off most people by the end of September, right?
Right, and then they'll keep on a skeleton crew to keep being able to pare it down and to finish out their obligations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so rough to see them going down.
Yeah, it is, especially because it's important to recognize there are some hidden costs there, such as, you know, not being able to pay for music licenses, which,
yeah,
for a place like All Classical, that'll be a huge expense. So this mm-hmm. is really a hard hit situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that'll affect KMHD as well. I'm curious how.
Exactly. Yeah.
Next, let's talk about a slightly more exciting topic, this lawsuit. The Oregon Humanities suit against Trump funding clawbacks has its first day in court. the lawsuit, arguing that the canceling of federal grants previously approved by Congress is illegal, is heard in Portland U.S. court. A decision might come next week. Will you tell me about the suit and what could happen from it?
Yeah, the news just keeps coming. Oregon Humanities is leading the national effort to sue the Trump administration for halting more than $200 million in grants that had been previously approved by Congress. And the case had its first hearing on Monday, August 4th. To provide some history, in April, the Trump administration suddenly terminated grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities to Oregon Humanities and 55 other state and jurisdictional humanities councils. In May, Oregon Humanities filed a federal lawsuit alleging the action was illegal, and it was joined in the lawsuit by the Federation of State Humanities Councils, which represents all but two of 56 councils nationally. An amicus, or a friend of the court brief, was also filed on behalf of 15 states, including Oregon, plus the District of Columbia. During the hearing on August 4th, lawyers for the Oregon Council for the Humanities in the states argued that the grant terminations violated the separation of powers provisions of the U.S. Constitution because the funds had already been approved by Congress. They also argued that terminations violated the Federal Administrative Procedures Act because notices or explanations weren't provided. A lawyer with the U.S. Attorney's Office argued that the NEH has changed its priorities and that grant notices say that grant money can be suspended. NEH grants are typically used to support libraries, especially in rural areas, as it is in Oregon. They support historical societies, museums, storytelling, and community conversation projects. For Oregon Humanities, the funding amounts to $2.58 million, or 44% of its budget, which was supposed to carry the organization through most of 2027. Oregon Humanities had to lay off staff and cut programs. The judge promised to issue a ruling as soon as next week. If we're getting any sense of how this might go, there was a similar lawsuit filed against the cancellation of NEH research grants. On July 25th, the New York U.S. District Court judge blocked the Trump administration's mass cancellation of the NEH grants, saying the action violated the constitutional right to free speech and the Administrative Procedures Act. So we'll see how this one in Oregon plays out.
Yeah, I'm curious. We'll see.
Yeah, especially since it's interesting that the Oregon Humanities is leading the way with the whole federal lawsuit for the whole nation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an important lawsuit and an important mm-hmm. thing to follow.
Yeah, it'll set a precedent for sure. Finally, let's talk about this article on the Grant County Library. The article is titled "Keep Our Library Open: Grant County Residents Urge County Commission." A packed public hearing in John Day this week shows substantial support for the library, with momentum building to create a special tax district. Will you tell me more about this?
Yeah, so in June, a three-member board voted to begin the process of defunding the one public library in Grant County, which is located in John Day. The next closest public library is more than an hour's drive away. A state law requires the county to hold two public hearings before voting to defund and then close the library. The first hearing was held July 22nd, and nearly 200 people showed up, which by everyone's assessment was a huge turnout for that area. Oregon Arts Watch reporter Amanda Waldrup was there as part of our expanded coverage of public libraries in crisis. Advocates at the hearing talked about the library being a community center, a gathering place, a safe place for kids. It provides free access to computers, printing services, and a Wi-Fi in a county where large swaths do not have cell or internet service. A bit of background about why the board voted to defund the library. The county faces a $1.5 million deficit in its upcoming budget. For years, Grant County's population has grown smaller. It's one of Oregon's most rural and sparsely populated counties. The area used to rely on the timber industry and ranching, but both industries have declined. The county has already eliminated its economic development department, the police department, and closed the public school. People are concerned that closing the library will accelerate the population decline. As one woman with three kids who was at the library said, how are families supposed to live here without a library? So almost immediately after the June vote to begin dissolving the library, a committee of 15 people formed to save it. That committee wants to create a special tax district that would make the Grant County Library independent of the county and create reliable, sustainable funding. The second hearing is scheduled for October 21st, and the library could close down right away after that, but everyone is hopeful that an alternative source of funding will be found.
Yeah, libraries are so important.
Yeah, and there's a lot of threats to them right now. There's been an increase in book challenges, which are at an all-time high, and threats to funding mechanisms. So we've actually ramped up our coverage because we realize that it's really an immediate issue. It's really something that is part of this, you know, just this current moment in time. It's really critical to find out what's happening and find out what's, you know, what are the different reasons why this is happening.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thanks for telling me about that coverage. Is there anything else that you want to add to that?
No, I think that's it.
Sweet. Where can folks read these articles?
You can read all these articles and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Great. Thank you so much for your time, Laura.
Yeah, thanks for having me today, Hannah.
That was Laura Grimes, Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Hannah Francis.
Are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon.
Running a group entirely with neurodiversity.